becoming a Substack premium newsletter subscriber. And of course, all of my children's books are available at davidpakman.com/book. I'll see you on the bonus show, and I'll be... With the modern Republican Party, allegations are often confessions. And the allegation that the failed former president Donald Trump has been making for months, if not years, that there is a weaponized justice system targeted at he, Trump, by Joe Biden, the current president, is not only completely without evidence. New reporting suggests that it's actually a confession of what Donald Trump plans to do to Joe Biden if he were to get elected and replace Biden in 2024. Axios reports, Trump and Republicans plot a 2025 criminal probe of the Bidens. Bidens, plural. Republicans' impeachment probe of President Biden is unraveling because of a lack of evidence, but their work could become the basis for federal investigations and even prosecutions of the Biden family if Trump wins re-election, Axios has learned. A source close to the Trump campaign says everything you have seen from the Biden DOJ, you can expect to see from the Trump DOJ. One Trump ally argued there is precedent for a second Trump administration to investigate and prosecute the Bidens, the current federal charges against Donald Trump. Where do you even start with something like this? Number one, the authoritarian framework of Project 2025 is not only at a general federal level, it is also part of this unflinching desire to get Biden for what Trump claims is Biden sicking the DOJ and I guess the Attorney General of New York and I guess the state of Georgia, right? I mean, you'd have to believe a lot of crazy things. But Trump is alleging Biden is running these investigations and indictments of him. There's no evidence of that. But what does appear to be the case, and Trump has alluded to it, and now Axios is reporting it directly, is that Trump's plan is to weaponize the Trump DOJ against Joe Biden. Now, understand that, again, Biden's been in elected office for decades. They have nothing on him. It has been the sole focus for some Republican members of the House to find the dirt on Biden. And they haven't even found impropriety by Joe Biden, never mind anything approaching criminality. The witch hunt that Trump claimed was against him and was meritless had merit. The witch hunt against Biden really does appear to be merely a witch hunt, and it has completely fallen through. And it's because the facts and the evidence aren't on the side of those going after Joe Biden. But it's not going to stop them from trying it. Once again, Catherine Stewart told us, Ellie Honig told us, all of these folks have told us, you have to believe these people when they tell you what they're going to do. And they are going to try. It is not going to stop them. And you know what? There's two sides to the James Comer realization that they're not impeaching Biden. Just as a reminder, James Comer has been one of the lead Republicans in the House who has been going on TV and pushing forward this Biden crimes narrative. They're just, all of the blockbuster evidence is just barely out of reach. They're about to get it. And he has now, Comer, has started sending out fundraising emails where he says, listen, the impeachment, it's not going to happen. Part of why it's not going to happen is Democrats control the Senate. They would never vote to convict. But the criminal referrals are why I need you to donate to me. And so they're being very clear. If you zoom out, Trump has alluded to it. Comer has said it. And Axios now has been able to report it. They want to remain in control of the House of Representatives in 2025 going forward. And they want to take control of the Senate in 2025 going forward with the idea that they are going to be able to completely and totally function as an arm to target Biden and his family. This includes criminal referrals, which hopefully a Trump DOJ will carry forward. Now, as far as bogus investigations go, they arguably made a mistake, and it was a timing mistake. And again, it's all projection. Trump has argued that these indictments came at the time to be most advantageous for Democrats and for Joe Biden. I have argued that that doesn't really make sense. It would have arguably been better if if Biden was directing Trump's indictments and they wanted to time it to be as useful to Biden's reelection as possible, they would be doing it later. They would be doing it now. They would be dropping the bombshells over the summer when more voters are paying attention. But again, the idea of timing of this stuff, what Republicans should have done to do more damage.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
German police proved beyond reasonable doubt by bursting in and interrupting the live stream, grabbing the microphone, ending that magnificent Congress, that fascism does not need to win government in order to be in power.
As the official death toll in Gaza nears 34,000, Germany's intensifying its crackdown on pro-Palestinian voices. On Friday, Berlin police raided and shut down a three-day Palestine Congress just minutes after it began. We'll speak with former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, who was barred from entering Germany and banned from addressing the conference, which his organization, DiEM25, helped organize. Then we'll talk to Palestinian journalist Dalia Hotuka, who says Western media coverage of Israel's war in Gaza has helped Israel avoid growing calls for a ceasefire.
This could not have been achieved without the complicity, unfortunately, of Western journalists across Europe and the U.S. who have manufactured consent for their government's unconditional support of Israel by uncritically parroting Israeli military disinformation and outright propaganda.
We'll also talk to Dalia Hotuka about increasing settler violence in the occupied West Bank. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An Israeli airstrike destroyed a mosque and homes in Gaza's northern Jabalia refugee camp. Many were reported injured, including children. Another attack on the Nusayrat refugee camp killed at least three people. In Rafah, grieving family members at the Al-Najjar hospital said their final goodbyes today to loved ones who were killed in an overnight Israeli airstrike. This is a Palestinian mother, Umrami Shabbat.
I lost my feelings. I lost my feelings. I don't have feelings anymore. Do I have feelings still? I'm going crazy. They should put me with my son. My son was very dear to me. He had five daughters and a son. His son is only 1 year old. He brought them to me for Eid, to sleep over, and they left, as if he was saying goodbye to them. This boy is attached to his father.
On Monday, doctors uncovered a new mass grave at the decimated Al-Shifa hospital. The bodies clearly belonged to patients, as some still had medical bandages and catheters attached to their dead bodies. Hundreds of bodies have been recovered from the Gaza City hospital grounds since Israeli troops ended their deadly siege April 1st. Attacks on health facilities, medical staff, and patients are considered war crimes and crimes against humanity. In news from occupied East Jerusalem, an Israeli court ordered the forced removal of three Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The families have lived in their homes for more than half a century and have been battling attempts by Israeli settlers to evict them since 2009. Tensions remain high throughout the region amid reports an Israeli response to Iran's weekend attack could be imminent. Iran warned Israel against launching any further military action 2 weeks after an Israeli attack killed at least two Iranian generals at its consulate in Damascus, Syria. This is Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian.
If the Israeli regime makes a mistake, this time Iran's response, as Iran's military commanders announced, will not be minimal, but immediate and severe.
UN legal experts say the Israeli attack violated international law. Meanwhile, the U.S. is reportedly preparing new sanctions against Iran. Activists across the globe carried out large-scale actions Monday as part of A15, a coordinated economic blockade in solidarity with Palestine. Here in the United States, organizers blockaded factories and corporate offices of weapons manufacturers, including the Boeing plant in St. Charles, Missouri, Pratt & Whitney in Middletown, Connecticut, and the Lockheed Martin building in Arlington, Virginia. Protesters took over major roads in Philadelphia and Oakland, while others rallied in front of government buildings and cultural sites. In San Francisco, activists shut down both sides of the Golden Gate Bridge in a major traffic disruption in the Bay Area. Here in New York, activists marched across the Brooklyn Bridge and rallied on both the Brooklyn and Manhattan sides of the iconic bridge. Dozens of people were arrested in the peaceful action, including reporters covering the protest. Protests continue as well on U.S. college campuses. A group of Yale graduate students launched a hunger strike Friday to demand Yale divest from companies arming Israel. Meanwhile, the University of Southern California, USC, has come under fire for canceling the commencement speech of the valedictorian Asna Tabassum for what the school claimed were safety reasons after she became the subject of an online anti-Palestinian hate campaign. Asna said, quote, "I am both shocked by this decision and profoundly disappointed that the university is succumbing to a campaign of hate meant to silence my voice," she said. In other news from New York, jury selection for Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial is entering its second day. The jury selection process could take up to 2 weeks. No jurors were chosen Monday. Dozens of potential jurors were dismissed after saying they could not be impartial in what's the first ever criminal prosecution of a U.S. president. Trump's charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to hide a $130,000 payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels in 2016. He could be sentenced to 4 years in prison if convicted. Trump's required to attend all the proceedings of this trial. The judge overseeing the case, New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan, told Trump if he fails to show up, quote, "there will be an arrest," unquote. The judge also threatened jail if Trump disrupted the trial. In Virginia, three Iraqi survivors of torture by U.S. guards at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq headed to federal court Monday for the start of a much-anticipated trial against U.S. military contractor CACI, which was hired to provide interrogation services at Abu Ghraib. The lawsuit was first filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights in 2008. Since then, CACI repeatedly attempted to have the case dismissed. Plaintiffs Suhail al-Shamari, Saad Zubai, and Salah al-Alajil accused CACI of conspiring to commit war crimes at Abu Ghraib. The three were subjected to sexual abuse, electric shocks, exposed to extreme temperatures, and death threats by their interrogators. Heavy rains and lightning in Pakistan have killed at least 50 people. Afghan authorities also reported at least 50 deaths due to rain and flooding in recent days as thousands have had to flee their homes. In 2022, UN Chief Antonio Guterres called the worsening annual weather events in the region monsoon on steroids as the climate crisis increases their frequency and intensity. Elsewhere, large swaths of northern Kazakhstan and Russia's Urals region have been inundated, forcing more than 125,000 people to evacuate as large snowfalls and heavy rains swelled the tributaries of the Ob River. Back in the U.S., the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, confirmed Monday the world's fourth global coral bleaching event is underway due to global heating.
Significant severe coral bleaching has been reported in at least 54 countries and territories around the globe since February 2023. So it's spatially extensive, occurring, again, in all ocean basins across multiple countries.
In Baltimore, Maryland, salvage crews found the body of a fourth victim of last month's Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse, which killed six construction workers. Two other bodies remain missing. This comes as the FBI launched a criminal investigation into the tragedy. The agency is reportedly looking into whether crew on board the massive cargo ship that struck the bridge were aware the vessel had serious electrical problems. In New Mexico, a judge sentenced Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, the weapons handler on the film Rust, to the maximum sentence of 18 months in prison for the involuntary manslaughter of cinematographer Helena Hutchins. Alec Baldwin, the star and producer of Rust, fired the loaded prop gun that killed Hutchins and injured director Joel Souza during a rehearsal in 2022. Alec Baldwin will face his own manslaughter trial in July. Civil rights groups warn the First Amendment right to protest could be in peril after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a key case brought by Black Lives Matter organizer DeRay McKesson. McKesson led a Black Lives Matter protest in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, following the police killing of Alton Sterling in 2016. A police officer was injured at the protest, triggering a lawsuit against McKesson, even though he himself did not injure the officer. The ruling against McKesson by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals could threaten organizers of any mass protest in Louisiana, Mississippi, or Texas. In other Supreme Court news, Justice Clarence Thomas was absent from the bench Monday without explanation and did not participate in remote arguments. At 75, Justice Thomas is the oldest and longest-serving member of the Supreme Court. And the pioneering Black multimedia artist, activist and author Faith Ringgold has died at the age of 93. Ringgold is best known for her vibrant quilts depicting African-American communities, especially in her native New York, and political messages. She spoke out against racism, Eurocentrism and patriarchy in the art establishment and became a champion for other Black women artists. She famously said, quote, "I just decided when someone says you can't do something, do more of it," she said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
As the official death toll in Gaza nears 34,000, we begin today's show looking at Germany's intensifying crackdown on pro-Palestinian voices. On Friday, police in Berlin shut down a three-day Palestinian conference just moments after it began. In addition, Germany's Interior Ministry banned several speakers from even entering Germany or addressing the Palestine Congress conference remotely. The Palestinian researcher Salman Abu Sitta opened the conference, but his remarks over a live stream were cut short when Berlin police raided the conference site.
We have never seen before these daily scenes, one massacre after another, homes demolished over the heads of the occupants, bodies pulled from under the rubble, surviving child with all his family killed. We have never seen before people deliberately denied food and water, children starved to death and killed when rushing to get food. We have never seen before all means of life systematically destroyed, hospitals, clinics, schools, universities, libraries, ancient monuments, mosques, churches, universities, cemeteries, bakeries, apartment buildings.
We ask you, so for all people in the live stream, the police is standing right in front of us and they ask us to stop the video.
They are even trying to take away this microphone.
That was a live stream capturing the moment when German police raided and shut down the Palestine Congress conference in Berlin just minutes after it began. On Friday, German authorities also detained and questioned the Palestinian-British surgeon, Dr. Hassan Abu Sitta, who had flown into Germany to speak at the Palestine Congress. Dr. Abu Sitta, who is the nephew of Salman Abu Sitta, who we just watched interrupted, spoke to Middle East Eye after he was barred entry.
Upon arrival, I was stopped at the passport office. I was then escorted down to the basement of the airport, where I was questioned for around 3.5 hours. At the end of 3.5 hours, I was told that I will not be allowed to enter German soil, that I will, and that this ban will last the whole of April, And not just that, that if I were to try to set, to link up my Zoom or FaceTime with the conference, even if I was outside Germany, or I were to send a video of my lecture to the conference in Berlin, then that would constitute a breach of German law, and that I would endanger myself to having a fine or even up to a year of prison.
That was the Palestinian British surgeon, Dr. Hassan Abu Sita, who had flown into Germany to speak at the Palestine Congress, but was denied entry to Germany. German authorities defended the decision to shut down the Palestinian conference, citing German laws against so-called hate speech. When Dr. Abu Sita came out of Gaza, we interviewed him, and you can go to democracynow.org to see that conversation. We're joined right now by former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis. He was also banned from entering Germany and barred from engaging in any political activity there. Varoufakis is a leader of the pan-European progressive movement, DiEM25, which helped organize the Palestine Congress. Welcome to Democracy Now! Yanis Varoufakis is the former finance minister of Greece. His most recent book is Techno-Feudalism. What Killed Capitalism is the subtitle. Yanis Varoufakis, can you explain what happened in Berlin?
To give you a vignette, Amy, of the absurdity, which would have been funny if it wasn't so tragic of what went on. During the morning, just before the police burst in, as you described so accurately, there was a young man who, an attendee of the Congress, a member of the Jewish Voice for Peace, which together with the Mera 25, DiEM25, we co-organized the Palestine Congress. And this young man, as he approached the police court, and there were 2,500 policemen preventing our attendees from attending the Congress. Anyway, he was approaching and he had a little placard that he had written with his own hand, and it read, "Jews against genocide." And for that, he was apprehended, arrested, manhandled. And while the police were manhandling him, he turned around humorfully or half-jokingly and said to them, "Would it have been all right with you if it said Jews in favor of genocide?" At which point, of course, they were far more angered and manhandled him even more fiercely. I'm conveying this to you, Amy, and to our listeners and viewers, because this shows the absurdity of the whole thing. The police entered the building, the venue, a few minutes before I was due to deliver my talk via video link. As a result, what I did was I recorded my talk and I posted it online from Greece, from Athens, where I'm even now. And the next day, I found out that a ban, as you put it, was slapped on me by the German authorities, a ban that harks back to laws against Nazis and a law that has only been used recently for ISIS operatives. That was used against me. Allow me just to briefly say that the rationale behind this is the Germans' Staatsraison, the logic or rationale of this German state to protect Jews, which is an excellent rationale. I wish every state had it, each one of us had it, to protect Jews, except that this is not about protecting Jewish lives and Jews from anti-Semitism. It's all about protecting the right of Israel to commit any war crime of its choice in the final analysis.
And Yanis Varoufakis, the Federal Interior Minister of Germany, not only applauded the police action, but she described the event, the conference, as an Islamist conference. What do you think of that characterization of the Palestine Congress?
Isn't it remarkably farcical that our Jewish comrades who helped us co-organize, put together this Congress, have been dismissed as Islamists? Let me be clear. There were no Islamists in this. And in any case, the reason why our Congress has been so, let's say, unpopular with the German political system is because the German political spectrum, and this is not just the government, this is also the opposition, including some members of the left, I say with deep regret, some of my former comrades, they insist on equating acts of terror, atrocities against civilians, which every soundly thinking person in the world should condemn, and I condemn, of course, and so do all the organizers of this Congress, equating, however, violence against civilians with a principled resistance to an apartheid state, which is part of a project of systematically, ethnically cleansing the population of the Palestinians. That is what they do not want. They do not want a Congress like ours, especially one that includes progressive Jews. That is the main thing that they detested, that they were Jewish demonstrators, Jewish activists, Jewish intellectuals, Jewish speakers with us, with one voice saying one thing alone, equal political rights, civil liberties from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. I'm neither a Jew nor a Palestinian. I don't have a view as to how this will be accomplished. But I think every single human person on this planet has an obligation, not a right, an obligation to demand from the river to the sea equal political rights. And the German political establishment does not want to listen to this. They simply want to associate anyone who opposes Netanyahu's government or any government in Israel that perpetrates genocide, essentially, to be associated, to be stigmatized as an anti-Semite, which, by the way, it is the anti-Semite's greatest dream come true.
Now, Germany has also banned the display of the Palestinian flag. How do you think the suppression of pro-Palestinian protests in Germany, has that spread to other countries in Europe? What's your sense of what's going on throughout the rest of the continent?
Not formally. The Palestinian flag has not been banned formally. But I can tell you that even here in Greece, anyone who is sporting the colors of Palestine walking on the street seriously risks being assaulted by ultra-rightists, being arrested, apprehended by police for some pretext. The bourgeois liberal democratic rights and principles have all been sacrificed on the altar of enabling Israel to complete the genocide which is carrying out. It is carrying out not just in Gaza, but as we heard before in the news bulletin, in East Jerusalem and in the West Bank. In the same way that in the 1930s, we all had an obligation, a duty, an ethical commitment, or should have had one, to support Jews and to show our solidarity to the Jewish people who were suffering from the Nazi regime, from the Croat Nazi regime, from the Greek fascists and so on, we have a duty today to end the genocide in ancient Palestine.
Yanis Varoufakis, as a former finance minister, a vocal critic of austerity, how do you perceive Germany's position on the war on Gaza in light of its significant arms sales to Israel? I mean, you have Nicaragua taking Germany to the International Court of Justice, saying that by providing weapons for Israel to carry out this war, that it's engaging in crimes against humanity or war crimes.
Well, Amy, it's interesting and I think not coincidental that on the Monday before the invasion, the incursion by the German police into our Palestinian Congress in the venue in Berlin, I happened to be in Milan, in Italy, in Milan, and I was giving a speech to a gathering of hundreds of financial analysts at the top, that creme de la creme of European financial experts. And in it, unbeknownst to me of what was going to happen later on that week, I outlined dire prognostications about the long-term damage inflicted upon Germany and Germany's social economy by decades of austerity, combined with impressive largesse for finances, what you call in the United States quantitative easing. And, you know, I was really surprised because here I am a lefty, addressing a gathering of hundreds of financial experts. Those hard-nosed financiers actually applauded me, and afterwards they came to me and they said that they agree with what I was saying. And I have to tell you that when that happens, I get really worried. Because if these hard-nosed financiers, many of them German, came to me and they said that they agreed with my prognosis that the German business model is kaput, is in dire straits, I start feeling very uncomfortable. So I think there is a connection. Because here you have a political system in Germany which understands in its bones that the economic dominance that the German industrial model had within the European Union for so many decades is now waning. And when such a regime feels threatened, feels that its economic prowess and authority and dominance is waning, it's really very easy for that to translate itself into movements that essentially fan the flames of increasing and increasingly farcical authoritarianism.
I also want to ask you, Yanis Varoufakis, about Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks. The Wall Street Journal is reporting now that the government of Australia asked the U.S. last week if it could reach a felony plea deal with Assange that could result in his return home. I think also today is the deadline for the U.S. government to answer questions that the British judges had, guaranteeing that he would not be given the death penalty if found guilty, and questioning what kind of free speech rights he would have.
Amy, before I answer your question, full disclosure, I am a very close friend of Julian Assange, and I have been part of the campaign to release him. His only crime is journalism. And because of that reality, I mean, think about it. What he has done is just straightforward journalistic work, which the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, the Spiegel used in order to reveal to the people of the United States, to the people of Germany, to the people of Britain and so on, about the crimes that our governments have perpetrated behind our backs in our name. That, you know, his crime was journalism. The Australian government, this government by Prime Minister Albanese, initially, after his election, claimed that he was demanding from the United States that the United States, and in particular Joe Biden, drop the charges and drop the request to the British authorities for Julian Assange's extradition. Clearly, they were not heard. And now they are talking about a plea bargain? I can tell you, Julian is never going, even if his life depends on it, and his life does depend on it, he's never going to plead guilty as if journalism is a crime. It is despicable that the government of Australia, given that Julian Assange is an Australian citizen, should be diminishing its own reputation by begging for a plea deal that essentially gives the United States authorities and the national security apparatus what they want. And that is a conviction for Julian. They cannot stand that Julian Assange has never been convicted of a crime. They want him to be convicted of a crime which they can then portray as a violation of American law, of America's statutes and so on. He's never violated any law, except that he has been a pain in the neck for those who were committing crimes in the name of the American people behind their backs.
And Yanis Varoufakis, we only have a few minutes left, but I did want to take the opportunity to ask you about your most recent book, Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism. I'm wondering if you could lay out some of the amazing arguments that you make, especially about the new feudal lords and the rest of us becoming serfs of techno-feudalism.
Thank you for the question. Look, the moment you enter Amazon.com, you've exited capitalism. It looks like capitalism, but it isn't. There are thousands of buyers and sellers, but we are all, whether we are buying or selling on Amazon.com, we are all the serfs of Jeff Bezos. He doesn't produce anything. He simply has encased us in that digital fiefdom, I call it a cloud fiefdom, using very powerful algorithmic capital, which I also call cloud capital. And every time you buy anything, from a book to an electric bicycle on Amazon.com, which he's not produced, he charges up to 40% to the vassal capital that has produced it. So markets have been replaced by these digital thieves and profit has increasingly been siphoned off into what is essentially a kind of rent, like the feudal lords of yesteryear used to charge rent or extract rent from the serfs. My view is that this is what already has happened. In other words, capitalism was killed by capital, not by us of the left, not by trade unions. Capital became so triumphant that, like a stupid virus, it mutated into a very toxic version which killed its host, capitalism. That's the basic premise of my book, with repercussions going as far as explaining the new Cold War between the United States and China, because, let's face it, the United States and China are the two places, countries, economic blocks that contain a lot of this cloud capital. Europe doesn't have it. The rest of the world doesn't have it.
You write that techno-feudalism enslaves our minds. It rewrites the rules of global power. But you also talk about ultimately what it will take to overthrow it. What are your thoughts on this, as the former Greek finance minister, Yanis?
Well, imagine a world in which you have the right to your own data, which cannot be harvested by anyone. And if anybody harvests it, you can actually sue them for billions. Then everything would change very, very quickly. Imagine if you, Amy, or I, you know, I want to leave Twitter, especially after Elon Musk took it. But if I go to Blue Sky or somewhere else, I lose a million followers. Imagine that you could carry your followers along with you through a piece of legislation that imposes interoperability. And if you want us to go a bit more radically to the left, imagine a world in which every corporation is owned by the people who work in them, that, you know, shares become like library cards in universities and colleges, where you simply get it while you're there and you lose it when you're not there. Suddenly, you have a very different world. And if you add to that a digital wallet provided by the Fed to every American resident, suddenly, why would you want to have an account with Bank of America or with Citigroup, who now own your money? They own the payment system. So these are some ideas that progressives can fight around the world. If we want to free ourselves from the clutches of the techno-feudal lords, which today not only force us to do things on their behalf, but actually very much train us to train them to input desires into our heads.
Yanis Varoufakis, want to thank you for being with us, former finance minister of Greece. His most recent book is Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism. German police just broke up a conference that was co-sponsored by his organization, DiEM25, dealing with Palestinian rights. Next up, we speak with Palestinian journalist Dalia Hatouka, who says Western media coverage of Israel's war on Gaza has helped Israel avoid growing calls for ceasefire. We'll also speak with journalist Peter Maas about his new piece for The Washington Post, I'm Jewish and I've covered wars. I know war crimes when I see them. Back in 30 seconds. Wayne El-Malayin, Where Are the Millions? By Julia Boutros. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Intercept is reporting the New York Times has instructed its reporters to avoid using the terms genocide, ethnic cleansing, and occupied territory in its coverage of Israel's war on Gaza. The Intercept's report is based on an internal memo from The Times. One newsroom source told The Intercept, quote, I think it's the kind of thing that looks professional and logical if you have no knowledge of the historical context of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. But if you do know, it'll be clear how apologetic it is to Israel, they said. Today, we're joined by a Palestinian journalist who's been highly critical of how the Western media has portrayed Israel's war in Gaza. Dalia Hatuka is an independent Palestinian journalist specializing in Israeli-Palestinian affairs, usually based between Amman, Jordan, and Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. She was a close friend and colleague of the Al Jazeera reporter Shireen Abu Akla, who was shot dead by an Israeli sniper in the occupied West Bank May 11th, 2022. Dalia's latest piece for the Century Foundation is headlined, Undercover of Gaza War, Assault on West Bank Accelerates. Dalia joins us now in our New York studio after speaking last night at the Columbia Journalism School. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. This was also the topic of your panel at the Columbia J School last night, the issue of how the conflict is being covered. What do you think is most important for people to understand, Dalia?
Well, I think that a lot of what's missing from the bigger portrait or the puzzle, so to speak, is the Palestinian voice. So in order to find out what's going on in Gaza, we need to not just rely on Western journalists coming into Gaza. I know that's very important, and it's a demand by a lot of us and by, you know, the Committee to Protect Journalists and other journalism rights groups. But it's also to amplify Palestinian voices, because ultimately nobody knows Gaza better than the Gazan journalists on the ground who are actually doing the work that they're doing right now. And in a way, these journalists, not only are they fighting for their lives while doing all of this, they're also resorting to extraordinary measures to be able to cover what's going on. And speaking to journalists on the ground, they tell us that what we're seeing from them is only like 10% of what's happening in Gaza at the moment.
And, Dalia, I wanted to ask you, the Western press does have the opportunity to cover what is going on in the West Bank. And yet this, as you wrote in a recent piece, more than 4,000 West Bank Palestinians have been displaced just in 2023, the highest number ever recorded. What is going on in the West Bank from what you've been able to see?
Basically, in the West Bank, the fog of war has allowed Israel to perpetuate crimes at a very large scale, not only throughout the West Bank, but including occupied East Jerusalem. And in the West Bank, we've got what a lot of even Israeli officials have admitted are pogroms that are going on by and being perpetrated by Israeli settlers, especially in villages around Nablus, for example, which are in the north, where there are many settlements surrounding villages. We're not talking about just, you know, the torching of houses and the torching of cars and whatnot. We're talking about people getting killed by armed settlers. And while they're being armed and attacking Palestinians, they're also being helped or aided by Israeli soldiers whose job technically is to be there to not allow such things to happen. But in a way, you know, sometimes they just sit by idly and not do anything, or they actually participate in these attacks. That's why when you look at the UN figures, a lot of the times we see, you know, 10 Palestinians have been killed by settlers, 2 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces. But then there is a line that says 3 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli settlers and or soldiers. So we don't know, because they are part of the system that's subjugating these Palestinians, that's, you know, carrying out all this violence against them.
And it's not just those who are killed, but also the detentions of Palestinians in the West Bank. Could you talk about the conditions that they're facing in Israeli custody?
The detentions, honestly, they're atrocious, and they are the least talked about, even among Western journalists who actually haven't been really mentioning this at all. We're talking about the least amount of you know, livable situations that can be that any detainee can live in. So they get water up to 2 hours a day now. Sometimes they don't get to shower. The food that they get is rotten. I'm talking about the detainees in the 9,000 or so in Israeli prisons. They don't have access to their families. They don't have access to lawyers. The people who have come out with some have had their limbs amputated because of the extended use of handcuffs. So honestly, the conditions are really harrowing, and there's not much access. And right now, as we speak, I was just seeing that there is a detainee who died in actually in an Israeli hospital a few days ago, and his body is still being withheld, and his family has not been able to put him to rest because even though he had already carried out his sentence 30 or more years, which is quite frankly a devastating thing for the family because they're unable to get any kind of closure.
You're talking, of course, about Waleed Daqqa. His human rights groups, everyone had asked for him to be released as he was there for almost 40 years and he was dying of cancer. Speaking of people who have died not in prison but outside, the last time I spoke to you was just after Shireen Abu Akleh was killed May 11, 2022, as she was a dear friend of yours, the Al Jazeera Arabic reporter outside the Jenin refugee camp, all laid out now, determined to be an Israeli sniper who killed her as her colleagues tried to reach her. They shot at them, clearly wearing press. It wasn't in the middle of any kind of skirmish. They were just standing outside. This issue of journalists being killed that you spoke of before, the memorial for Shireen outside Jenin has now been bulldozed over, destroyed by the Israeli military. But even in Gaza, and you took this up last night, you and your colleagues on the panel, of what's happening to journalists. Even you were surprised, you said, as we spoke before the show, by learning about when David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, asked, how do you know that journalists are targeted? Talk about the response.
Basically, we were very lucky to have a journalist from Gaza who managed to leave the coastal enclave, the besieged coastal enclave, to Qatar. Her name is Amira Harouda, and she had to leave, obviously, because, you know, for her well-being and her family, she has four kids. Anyways, she was talking about the fact that journalists would get phone calls from Israeli authorities, military authorities, basically questioning them about their work, especially if they worked for Qatar, which is a little strange considering that Qatar is the go-between, you know, between Israel and Hamas for the talks to reach a ceasefire and to release the hostages. So, in the meantime, also CPJ, you know, was talking to a few journalists who were released after being detained, and they had been taken away for 33 days, made to sit in squatting positions in horrific conditions. They came out, you know, having lost 30 kilos or so. There's a lot going on in that sense, but also the targeting of journalists. People know because there are UAVs or drones, as we say, constantly hovering in Gaza. It's so perpetual that people in Gaza, if they don't hear a UAV, they think something's wrong. UAVs have been part of the Gaza skyline for years, long before October 7th.
And even the phone calls from the Israeli military to journalists threatening them?
Yes, absolutely. And in the West Bank, they do the same thing. They call them in, they say, we want to have a chat with you, and then they don't come out because, you know, they take them in, they can put them in administrative detention, which, as you know, is basically when you put people in or Palestinians in prison without any kind of proof or without charging them. And it's very easy to do that. I mean, right now there's a young Christian girl who's a student. She's in administrative detention for 4 months. And I know that the Archbishop of Canterbury was calling for her release. So all these things are intertwined. There's a lot of things going on that are far-reaching. It's not just about journalists.
And the journalists who are being detained in Gaza are being questioned about their reporting?
Absolutely.
Interrogated for hours?
Absolutely, because the questions that they were being asked is, why did you write this? Why did you say this? Do you talk to Hamas people? Of course they talk to Hamas people. It's their job. It's like how you talk to Israeli forces, how you talk to Israeli military personnel or government officials. I mean, that's your job as a journalist. Your job is to talk to people.
And I wanted to ask you, Dalia Hatouka, you're usually based in Amman, Jordan, or in Ramallah in the West Bank, but you're here in the United States now. What's your message to the American public and to the Biden administration, given that this country is the largest supplier of weapons and military aid to Israel?
I think, honestly, the American public has been very instrumental in working with Palestinians. Large segments of the American public have been working with Palestinians. I've seen a lot of support. I've seen a lot of support among Israelis. You know, the few Israelis who get it. I've seen a lot of support among American Jews, and I believe that they are one of the Palestinians' biggest allies. But my message, obviously, to Biden is, I mean, there's a lot at stake right now. The Biden administration can do so much, and that's been proven over by the fact that, you know, once Biden put his foot down, several steps were taken by Israel in order to open the border crossings or some of the border crossings into Gaza. But I believe that taking this kind of blind support for Netanyahu is leading us nowhere. And as an American as well, not only as a Palestinian, I have bigger fears of what's to come November, because if Biden loses the election, and he might because of the situation, because of what's going on in Gaza, then we are doomed, basically, to have another 4 years of a Trump administration. So in my mind, I'm like, you know, we are doomed in the Middle East. We're doomed in the U.S. And I know that's a lot of doom and gloom. But honestly, these are some of the thoughts that people, especially dual nationals like me, these are some of the thoughts that they have.
Dalia Hatouka, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian independent journalist, usually based between Amman, Jordan, and occupied Ramallah. That's Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Next up, we speak with journalist Peter Maas. He has a new piece for The Washington Post. It's headlined, "I'm Jewish and I've Covered Wars. I Know War Crimes When I See Them." Stay with us.
ما دمنا باقون صبا كنهر الغيم. ما ببشع الدموع لما العاجز يكون نصيب وسكوت يحتل كل حواسك وهموم مستني الدفا لكن هاي نار بتحرق البيوت.
If only once by Big Sam. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with journalist Peter Maas, who has written an opinion piece for The Washington Post headlined, "I'm Jewish and I've covered wars. I know war crimes when I see them," unquote. Until recently, Peter was a senior editor at The Intercept. He's the author of Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War. He covered the Bosnia War for The Washington Post and the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq for The New York Times Magazine. Peter, welcome to Democracy Now! You begin your piece in The Washington Post by saying, "How does it feel to be a war crimes reporter whose family bankrolled a nation that's committing war crimes? I can tell you." Lay it out for us.
Well, my great-great-grandfather was Jacob Schiff, who was a financier at the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, one of the wealthiest people in the country, probably, who donated a lot of money and organized the movement of Jews, persecuted Jews from Europe, largely from Russia, but also from other countries in Russia, to any safe haven that would have them, including America, but also significantly British-controlled Palestine. And then his son-in-law, my great-grandfather, Felix Warburg, who married Jacob Schiff's daughter, continued that process of supporting and helping to organize the migration of persecuted Jews from Europe to British-controlled Palestine. This is before World War II, the Holocaust, and the establishment of Israel.
Yet you say they were anti-Zionists. Can you explain?
Well, they were non-Zionists, which was actually different, significantly different from being anti-Zionist. There was a movement amongst American Jews and Jews elsewhere in Europe that was called non-Zionism. And for them, the non-Zionists, the point was Jews should be able to go to British-controlled Palestine. They need to go to British-controlled Palestine because they need refuge from the persecution they're suffering in Europe. But they were against the establishment of a Jewish state for two reasons. One is that they were concerned that if there were a Jewish state, then all the anti-Semites in America and elsewhere would look at Jews who are not living in this Jewish state and say, you know, your loyalty is actually this other country. And that would kind of increase suspicions of Jews and make them seem lesser citizens in the countries that they were living in. And then the second concern, which is one that a lot of people had, but that non-Zionists also had and pronounced, was they were concerned about violence between Arabs and Jews. They just kind of said, look, you know, if one side, the Jews or the Arabs for that matter, try to exert total control over the state that's going to be established there, because remember, at this time, Palestine was under the control of British mandate, then it's going to be really violent. My great-grandfather referred to it as a shooting gallery.
And Peter, you also covered the wars in Croatia and Bosnia. And could you talk about how your journalism there helps inform your perspective of what's going on? Because many of course, our listeners and viewers are not familiar with those wars and the war crimes committed there.
In the early 1990s, Yugoslavia, which was a kind of conglomeration of different republics, five or six, I forget the precise number, actually, began to fall apart. And instead of falling apart peacefully, it fell apart violently. And there was first a war when Slovenia, one of the republics, seceded. And then there was an even larger war when Croatia, another one of its constituent republics, seceded. And then when Bosnia did the same, this was in 1992, this was unfortunately the largest war of all. There were a significant number of Serbs who lived in Bosnia. And Slobodan Milosevic, who was the leader in Belgrade of kind of all Serbs in the country, organized the kind of provisioning of military material and soldiers, guerrilla fighters, paramilitaries, to go in and basically fight against the Muslims and Croats in Bosnia who wanted to have an independent state and who voted in a referendum for an independent state. And the warfare, which I went to cover, it was not your ordinary war of army against army. It was a war of paramilitaries committing atrocities against defenseless civilians, largely Muslims, some Croats. And it also consisted of sieges against the few cities that were able to resist the onslaught. Sarajevo was one of these cities. Srebrenica was another one of these cities. And so I was there covering this war, seeing terrible things happen that are not supposed to happen in war. I mean, wars are violent. Civilians get killed in wars, but it's not always illegal. In this case, there were civilians right under my window in Sarajevo getting shot by snipers. I wrote about that. There were civilians whose houses were getting bombed. There were civilians who were standing in bread lines who were getting bombed and killed. There were aid shipments of medicine and food that were being prohibited from entry into these so-called safe areas because they were supposed to have been protected by the United Nations, but were not. And so I was there reporting on this. And in 1993, a year after this war began, there was an international criminal tribunal that was set up to investigate war crimes and possible genocide that was occurring at the time in Bosnia. And that tribunal subsequently did hold a number of trials, including a senior Bosnian Serb leaders, the military leader Ratko Mladic, the political leader Radovan Karadzic, and the Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic, in which the charges included genocide. And both Karadzic and Mladic are now in jail for the rest of their lives on charges that include genocide. So I was reporting on this genocide.
As you compare what you saw in Bosnia to what you saw in Gaza, you write in that piece, when I reported from besieged Sarajevo, I stayed in a hotel that was smack on the front line with Serbian snipers routinely firing at civilians walking under my window. On a spring day in 1993, I heard the familiar crack and whistle of a sniper's bullet, followed by an awful scream. I went to my window and saw a wounded civilian trying to crawl to safety. Writing in the Post more than three decades ago, I described the man's desperate shouts as a mad howl of a person pushed over the edge. It came from the lungs, from the heart, from the mind, you write in the Washington Post. You also write about disturbing video footage from Gaza that shows Halakhres walking on a so-called safe route in January with her grandson, five-year-old Taim Adel, who was holding a white flag when she was shot and killed by an Israeli sniper. Talk about the comparisons or what you call the rhymes.
Yeah, I mean, God, I remember those stories so well. This is the most... There's so many disturbing things going on in Gaza now and in the West Bank. But as the Israeli attack began after the Hamas attack on October 7th against Israel, you know, we began seeing these videos and reports emerging from these very brave journalists in Gaza of what was happening. And, for example, that video of this grandmother being shot, obviously quite intentionally. And everything that I was seeing, flower line massacres in Gaza, for example, airdrops of humanitarian aid that killed some of the people they were intended to help because they landed on top of these people, also happened in Bosnia. I began seeing just the same kinds of incidents that were the constituent elements in Bosnia of genocide also happening in Gaza, but kind of most disturbing in a way, at a scale that was larger than Bosnia. I mean, for example, you know, in Bosnia, over the course of its four-year war, there were something like 7,000 or 8,000 children killed, which is terrible. In Gaza, over the course of just 6 months, there have been more than 13,000 children killed. So, you know, I just could not help but see not only the parallels, but also how what seems to be unfolding in Gaza is even worse than what I saw in Bosnia.
And we have less than a minute left, but I'm wondering your perspective on how the U.S. media has been covering the war in Gaza.
It's been a real mixed bag, and it was a real mixed bag in Bosnia. You know, and we're all kind of captives of our experiences, and so I covered the war in Bosnia. I also covered other wars, so, you know, I may be talking too much about Bosnia, but I think it is relevant. In Bosnia, there was exceptionally good coverage, I think, and I'm biased on this, but I think, from the journalists who were on the ground, largely foreign journalists, but also a lot of Bosnian journalists. Really good coverage of actually what was going on. But then in the foreign capitals, in Washington, D.C., but also London and France, France and Britain were very important elements of the international community at the time. The reporting was terrible because it reflected the kind of briefings that the journalists were getting from all their government sources and all the think tank people, and they were just saying, oh, it's a
mess.
We have
15 seconds, Peter.
Each other. So we have the same problem now where there's a lot of bad coverage coming out of the capitals, such as Washington, although from the ground itself, reporting's quite excellent.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Peter Maas, journalist, former senior editor for The Intercept, author of Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War. We'll link to your latest piece in The Washington Post. He also covered U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq for The New York Times. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm Ella Harp, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Sitting lotus on the floor, belly dancing beauty with a power-driven soul. Had my share of nightmares, didn't think it'd be much more. In walked Rodney Garshaw with Lady Eleanor. She tied my eyes in the ribbons of a silken ghostly thread. I gazed with troubled vision on an old four-poster bed, where Eleanor had risen to kiss the neck below my head. Bid me come along with her to the land of the dancing dead. But it's all right, Lady Eleanor. All right, Lady Eleanor. I'm all right where I am. Like a mother to his son, like living, dying, seeing, being all rolled into one. Then all at once I heard some music in my bones. Same old song heard for years, reminding me of home. But it's all right, Lady Eleanor. Then creeping on towards me, licking lips with tongues of fire. A host of golden demons screaming lust and base desire. When it seemed for certain that the screams could get no higher, I heard a voice above the rest screaming, "You're alive." But it's alright.